Welcome to the New World. Episode 13, Success and Failure. Last time, we took a brief aside from our narrative to talk about Charles V, the man who ruled an empire upon which the sun never set. Now, I'd like to return to talking about the buzz of activity spreading across the coast of the Caribbean, as more people from across Europe attempt to find riches and power in the New World. This is going to be another broad sweep across the Spanish territories, discussing all the goings-on during the 1520s. In 1519, the same year that Hernán Cortés and his men set out from Cuba for Mexico, a Portuguese navigator known to the Spanish as Fernando de Magallanes set out on a voyage of his own. Though Cortés would complete his trip in only a few days, Ferdinand Magellan's voyage would take his men 3 years and the entire length of the globe. A few years earlier, Magellan had been to the East Indies, by what we may call Malaysia today. He proposed a westward voyage to the same place, just as Columbus had done decades before. The only difference was that Magellan knew exactly how big the world was, and that there was, in fact, the massive American landmass in his way. He believed that a strait lay to the south that would allow him to bypass America and make his way into the Pacific, whereby he could continue westward to the Spice Islands and give Spain unfettered access to eastern trade. Due to his personal beef with Portuguese King Manuel, he was not able to sail from Lisbon, so Spain would have to suffice. And suffice it did. Magellan set sail with 5 ships and 250 men on September 20th. As it turns out, he was correct about the strait at the southern tip of South America. He passed through the strait, which still bears his name, and sailed on into the Pacific. Attrition would take its toll on the fleet, and after storms, rebellions, and conflicts with natives which would kill Magellan himself, only one ship and 18 survivors limped their way back into Spain on September 6, 1522. Though they lost nearly everyone, even their captain, they had become the first Europeans to sail around the world, an accomplishment which cannot be ignored. This was an age where an enterprising and determined man could earn himself a great reward for his efforts. After the surrender of Cuauhtémoc to Hernán Cortés, many of the Spaniards' underlings came to the same realization. Each of them began to think, if Cortés could conquer an empire with only a few thousand Spanish troops, why can't I do the same thing? Over the course of this episode, we'll see many such attempts to emulate this success. Some will end fairly well. Some will result in utter disaster for all those involved. Let's start in a familiar territory, that of New Spain. Though I covered a bit of the post-conquest aftermath in episode 11, there are a few more things worth mentioning. In 1522, Cortés sent one of the first major treasure fleets back to Spain. On board were many treasures of Mexico, including gold, pearls, feathers, and even wildlife. Hugh Thomas makes particular note of a rubber ball, something the Spanish hadn't seen before. However, much of this treasure was taken by French pirates off the coast of the Azores before it could reach Spain. Piracy would soon grow in the Caribbean, but this is the first major incident of Spanish treasure fleets being looted that I had heard of. King Charles, or should I say Emperor Charles, named Cortés the governor and commander-in-chief of New Spain not long afterwards. Since the full extent of what Cortés now controlled was still pretty unclear, the emperor gave him a bit of leeway when it came to what he could do and where he could do it. Not only did this give Cortés the authority he needed to rule New Spain as something of a dictator, it also gave him and his subordinates all the permission they needed to make further moves in the region. I've already talked about some conquistadors who launched conquests throughout Mexico, but today let's discuss Francisco de Garay. Garay was the governor of Jamaica, and a veteran of Columbus's second voyage 30 years earlier. Perhaps he wanted to assist Cortés in the pacification of Mexico, or maybe he just took a look at his own island possession and thought, I can do better. Either way, in June of 1523, he left Jamaica with over 800 men, bound for New Spain. He landed near the modern city of Panuco, a ways up the coast from Veracruz, and founded his own town of Victoria Garayana, or Victorious Garay. Cortés, who had actually known Garay from back in Hispaniola, sent him a friendly letter, promising support if he ever got into trouble. Not only did Garay find this letter quite disingenuous, he also ended up telling the local Huastec citizens that he had come to free them from Cortez's tyranny. While Garay landed with quite a few men, they quickly suffered large losses from attrition. The heat, mosquitoes, disease, and wilderness took a large toll, and men began to desert in droves. Cortez even sent men to steal ships and artillery once he realized Garay was being a little unfriendly. Before long, an increasingly sick Garay had to go to Mexico City to make peace, before he passed away on Christmas Day that same year. Well, so much for that. One far more successful venture was that of the Alvarado brothers. Pedro de Alvarado was a lieutenant of his childhood friend Cortez, who had enjoyed great success for the past couple years. Not long after helping to deal with Garay's would-be coup, Governor Cortez decided to send him southeast to Guatemala. With only a little over 300 men and his three brothers in tow, they made the difficult trek overland over the course of a month. Guatemala was inhabited by several different cultural groups, notably the Quiches and the Caxiquels. They were all cultural subdivisions of the Mayans and had close contact with the Aztecs back in the day. Hugh Thomas claims they worshipped Tlaloc, the Aztec rain god, and that they used hornet-filled grenades in battle. He also makes particular note of the high-class poetry written in the area, dating back over 1,000 years, a tradition not uncommon to Mayans. However, another touchstone of Mayan culture was war, and the Quiches and Caxiquels had been warring against one another for a long time over the valuable land used for cotton or cacao growth. Alvarado, shortly after arriving in the area, asked all the parties to submit themselves to him and Emperor Charles. When this predictably went nowhere, as the Guatemalans probably had no idea who the hell Charles was, he inserted himself into the local conflict on the side of the Caxiquels. Mirroring the strategy of Cortez, he divided the local peoples of Guatemala against one another until he became the strongest party. During this time, Alvarado also followed the example of his forebears by committing crimes against humanity, burning cities that did not submit to him with their inhabitants still inside. Even his men at the time thought that he had gone too far, but their pleas to have these actions investigated went nowhere. But regardless, the people of Guatemala were cowed into submission, and in 1524, the Alvarados founded their first capital of Santiago de Guatemala. A different lieutenant of Cortez, Cristobal de Olid, was certainly not having so much success. He was the one who was sent by Cortez to conquer Honduras. He was the one who ended up potentially plotting against Cortez for his own independence, and he was the one who Cortez launched an overland expedition against, which resulted in the execution of Emperor Cuauhtémoc along the way, and the chaos in Mexico City in the governor's absence. After Olid was killed by his own men, Cortez returned to his capital in 1526, only to discover that the people he left behind had decided not only that he was dead, but that he was a greedy tyrant. Perhaps it wasn't an entirely inaccurate description. In any case, the men in charge, Pedro Chirino and Gonzalo de Salazar, set out to find his personal treasure and kill anyone still loyal to him. Cortez's arrival restored order, but literally 2 weeks later, a man named Luis Ponce de Leon arrived from Spain, with orders to retire Cortez officially and judge his past actions. Cortez must not have been looking forward to this, but then Ponce de Leon came down with food poisoning from something he ate on the way up from Veracruz and died. His successor also died. Despite this string of rather convenient deaths, the writing was on the wall for Cortez, and he took a step back from power for the next 2 years. While the Spanish were encroaching on Central America from Mexico in the north, they were also encroaching from Panama in the south. You may recall the man who became the governor of Spanish Panama, known colloquially as Pedro Rias. This man, now over 70 years old, still controlled the Central American colony with an iron fist since he seized the territory from the hands of Vasco Núñez de Balboa years earlier. He had founded the city of Panama in 1519 and distributed Native American slaves to his encomenderos. With control of their territory secured, they also sought to expand to the richer lands that they had only heard about beforehand. In 1523, two of Pedro Rias' underlings set out to the north, toward the territory of Guatemala, which the Alvarados were already in. Going first from the coast, then overland, they encountered several local lords with whom they spoke and established relations. Perhaps they also convinced them to become Christian in exchange, by diplomacy, force, or otherwise. One of these lords was a man we know of as Nicaragua. Nicaragua was, according to Thomas, converted to Christianity by Gil Gonzalez Davila after a long conversation about the truth of universe and existence. Thomas also claims that while Davila was mightily impressed with the urban centers and fancy palaces of Nicaragua's realm, he reported that the locals sacrificed women by pushing them into volcanoes. I'm not really sure about that personally, but it certainly makes for an interesting story. In any case, after exploring the length and breadth of what we now know of as the nation of Nicaragua, the Spanish established several colonies in the area and commenced looting and enslaving the locals. The greatest threat to the conquistadors, however, ended up not being the indigenous people, but one another. Several battles ended up being fought between rival bands of Spaniards who wanted to cement their personal authority over the country. The man who came out on top of all this infighting was none other than Pedro Rias, who left the dense mosquito-infested jungles of Panama for the black, rich volcanic soil and the beautiful shores of Nicaragua. For some time now, the Spanish in Panama had also been hearing about a land to the south, which was apparently a host to another great empire. This land, known to them as Biru, had much of the same potential for them as Mexico did to Cortes. One man who took immediate action on this was Francisco Pizarro. You may remember Pizarro from episode 7 as the man who assisted Balboa in colonizing Panama, then assisted Pedro Rias in arresting and executing Balboa. Pizarro was an illiterate but strong officer from Extremadura, the same region as his second cousin Hernán Cortés. Also like Cortés, he was the illegitimate son of a veteran aristocrat and soldier. You already heard his story in the Americas and Panama specifically up until now, but you should know that he had the charisma and bravery that made him a natural leader, as many conquistadors did. It was this leadership that made him one of the first to organize an expedition to the south. But how do you get to the south? As you may remember, mainland Panama is very mountainous, and Balboa had to take an arduous overland journey just to get from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast. Walking south to Biru would have been an even tougher journey into the increasingly mountainous Andes foothills. The only real option, then, was to go along the west coast, in what the Spanish were still calling the Southern Sea. Over the course of the mid-1520s, Pizarro would set off on 3 voyages to discover where exactly Biru was. The first expedition in 1524 didn't produce much, but the 1526 expedition was much more interesting. Pizarro would encounter a trade vessel in the middle of the ocean. Thomas calls this a raft, but Charles Mann refers to it as a ship just as large as one of Pizarro's caravels, though it was made of balsa wood. In any case, it was crewed by 14 men with all of their goods. These included gold, silver, clothes in many colors made out of cotton, and measuring devices to weigh out payment. This was the first official contact between the Spaniards and the Inca. Unknown to the Spanish, who took 3 of the merchants hostage, the Inca were already familiar with Spanish in one way. An epidemic of what we know of as smallpox was ravaging Peru, the same epidemic that had arrived in Mexico years earlier. After a brief incident involving being stranded on an island for a few weeks, Pizarro made it to the Incan port city of Tumbes, where he and his men were very well received. They exchanged gifts with the harbor master, and thousands of locals were intensely interested in these bearded foreigners, particularly their black slave. The Spanish, for their part, were very interested in the many silver and goldsmiths in the city. Pizarro would turn back not long after, but now he had confirmation that Biru was real, and dreams of its riches danced in his head. Yes, he would be back. Back home in Spain, Emperor Charles was in the middle of his 7-year stay following the uncertainty of the Comunero revolt. He presided over many councils that governed Castile in his name. If you listened to the previous episode, you would know that one of these councils was the Council of the Indies. Established in 1523, this council approved expeditions, named governors and viceroys, and heard complaints and appeals. While we've seen plenty of stories of conquistadors acting with complete autonomy, it was the Council of the Indies who had ultimate authority over Spanish America at the end of the day, and it was they who people like Cortes and Pedro Rias would ultimately answer to once their lands were conquered. During the 1520s, they would make a lot of key choices that are worth mentioning. In 1526, in a meeting presided over by Emperor Charles, the council would make a declaration of better treatment for Native Americans. While people back in Spain had always opposed the violent actions taken by conquistadors, they had no real ability to stop them until after these actions had already taken place. Part of this better treatment was an enforcement of the use of the requerimiento. Established in 1513 with the laws of Burgos, the requerimiento was supposed to be read by a conquistador upon their arrival in a new land. In theory, it was supposed to be read in the presence of natives so that they could understand its contents. However, these contents said that they claimed the land for Spain and intended to teach the natives Christianity and uplift them into tax-paying Jesus lovers in the service of Emperor Charles. If you were a native who heard the requerimiento, you likely couldn't understand it since you couldn't speak Spanish. In the event that you could, or if a translator was present, you probably wouldn't like what you heard. Therefore, conquistadors found fun and clever ways to get around this problem, such as reading it at night when everyone was asleep, or even on the boat over to their destination. With these problems in mind, the council decreed that multiple translators were required to accompany expeditions to ensure that natives would be able to understand the declaration. Also along for the ride were multiple council-appointed church officials who needed to ensure that Christianity was immediately preached to the natives and ensure that the conquistadors weren't too brutal in their conquest of these foreign lands. At the same time that they were decrying the mistreatment of Indians, the council was ensuring that African slavery in America was ramped up. The growing number of mines, farms, and plantations in the New World all needed laborers to staff them, and the ever-shrinking number of Native Americans were far from adequate for this task. Thomas claims that even the Bishop of Santo Domingo would claim that the economy of the West Indies could not survive without more Africans. Up until now, the need for slaves in Spain had been satisfied by markets of Muslims of West African ancestry born in Europe. But beginning around 1530, slaves were increasingly brought in directly from Portuguese bases off the coast of Africa, such as the island of Sao Tome. This was an important step in the growth of the transatlantic slave trade. It meant that now, the Europeans had direct access to African slaves. Both Cortes and Pizarro would meet the Council of the Indies in the late 1520s. Cortes, for his part, had gotten off the boat in 1528, seeking some sort of recompense after losing power in New Spain. For his troubles, he would get a new wife to replace the one that he might have murdered, and his title as the Marquess of the Valley of Oaxaca was received. While this wasn't the power and influence he once had, it still made him richer than most Europeans. Pizarro would arrive in 1529, seeking a title of his own, the governorship of Biru. He had traveled south enough times to collect a few more objects from that land, such as llamas and Incan gold, plus, of course, promises of much, much more. The council was impressed, and named him the governor of New Castile, as they called it. This was, of course, provided that Pizarro could actually conquer this land in the first place. Before leaving, Pizarro and Cortes actually met and exchanged words. Though we don't know what they said, one can only imagine Cortes giving pointers on how to conquer and subjugate an entire civilization. Pizarro was hardly unique in receiving a governorship from the council. There were, of course, the Alvarado brothers in Guatemala, but another was Panfilio de Narváez, who went to Florida. You remember Panfilio de Narváez. In 1520, he was sent by Cuba's governor Velázquez to arrest Cortés, but then he got the tables turned on him, and he became the arrested one. Since then, he had spent his time in the company of Cortés, but in 1527, with Cortés out of power and the conquest of Mexico well underway, Narváez sought a governorship of his own. This he received for the uncolonized peninsula of Florida, which had been explored but not settled by Ponce de León a decade ago. He would leave Spain in June with about 600 men, and just about everything would get worse after that. Shortly after landing near something that was probably Tampa Bay, he figured that he needed to reach the town of Panuco in New Spain, only a short way to the west, and that all he needed to do so was walk around the Gulf Coast. As it turns out, he was wrong on the distance by a few hundred miles, but that didn't stop him from sending his ships on ahead and attempting the trip overland. The climate and terrain of Florida was treacherous, and the local Apalachee natives were unfriendly at best, and supplies were quickly dwindling. The conquistadors trudged past Mobile Bay, but they soon decided that they'd had enough of overland travel and fashioned rafts upon which they could float westward. In the Gulf of Mexico, they encountered a storm, and Narváez's raft floated away and disappeared. What few survivors floated to shore remained in and around modern-day Texas for about 6 years, unable to continue onward and at the mercy of the local Native Americans who had them perform various jobs as indentured servants. One of these survivors, Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, would finally make it back to New Spain in 1536, nearly 10 years after leaving, and would write about his travels. Thus, he remains our only source for the failed Narváez expedition. Florida would remain out of Spanish hands for several more decades. I'd like to complete our sweep of Spanish America by discussing the developments along the coast of South America, which saw its own wave of Spanish colonization late in the 1520s. The most interesting of these was the colonization of Venezuela in 1528, not by the Spaniards, but by the Germans. That's right, the Germans. How did this come to pass? Well, it has everything to do with the economic policy of Emperor Charles. You see, the Americas were not yet the massive cash cow Charles was hoping for, and his wars across Europe were bleeding him dry. Therefore, he returned to private financiers to dole out loans to fund his armies. One of these bankers was the Welser family out of Augsburg. They traded in all sorts of luxury goods across the world, even having a branch in Santo Domingo. In 1526, Charles took out a loan with the quote-unquote island of Venezuela as collateral. And in 1528, they hammered out a deal to manage settlements in that area. The Council of the Indies approved the deal, and the Welsers became the leaders of 300 men setting out to Venezuela. As you might expect, they sought the usual things: gold, either from mines or Indians, and land with which to give out to their subordinates. However, Klein Venedig, as it's known in German, was not all it was cracked up to be. At the time, there were only two settlements in the area, Santa Marta and Coro. The new German governor, Ambrosius Alfinger, was apparently appalled at the living conditions in Coro especially, and so he founded his own settlement of Maracaibo on the shores of Lake Maracaibo, which he erroneously thought might be a passage to the Pacific. Attacks from the natives and a shortage of imported African slaves would keep the German ventures in Klein Venedig from growing much further, and the Spanish would undercut the German authority in the area by giving Diego de Ordaz the authority to sail down the nearby Orinoco River. German Venezuela would not be taking off anytime soon. Well, I think I'm going to leave things there. I covered a hell of a lot, and I don't blame you if most of it sailed right over your head. The main takeaway here is that even as Cortes and his former underlings sought to expand their power and acted with almost complete autonomy in some cases, the Council of the Indies was beginning to assert itself as the authoritative body that would keep them in check. They decreed better treatment for Native Americans, but at the same time supported the expansion of slavery in the area for Africans. Finally, while some of these ventures, such as Nicaragua and Guatemala, were successful, others, like Florida and Venezuela, were definitely not. The Spanish are certainly still expanding their reach, but they are far from an all-conquering force that can trample any resistance they encounter. If you are an all-conquering force, why not email us at historyoftheneworld@gmail.com? While you're at it, why not subscribe or follow us on whatever platform you're listening? Make sure to also give us a good review. It helps grow the audience and inspires me to make more episodes. Next time, we'll dive headfirst into the forests of the Yucatan Peninsula and meet some people we've been sailing around for years. The Mayans.